Coming up on Star Stuff, how hot young stars can change the evolution of entire galaxies. The Martian meteorite, which has reignited debate about the possibility of life on the red planet. And the new review, which has confirmed that billions of years ago the moon had a magnetic field. Not only that, but it was much stronger than the Earth field is today. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
A new studies discovered that powerful streams of radiation generated by hot young massive stars can change the evolution of entire galaxies. The findings, reported in the journal Nature, show that this radiation can be strong enough to blast star-forming material out of a galaxy, thus providing a type of stellar feedback mechanism controlling the amount of stars a galaxy can contain. Stars are formed out of collapsing clouds of dense molecular gas and dust. Once the nascent star is formed, it generates powerful stellar winds, which clear out the remaining molecular clouds from its vicinity. One of the study's authors, Assistant Professor Ryan Hickox from Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, says it's the first time he's seen a population of stars at the center of a galaxy, producing enough radiation to blow molecular gas almost completely out of a galaxy. Astronomers have long known that stellar winds blow star-forming material away from themselves in the Milky Way galaxy, but they've never before seen stars doing this on such a large scale. Hickox and colleagues made their discovery while studying a distant compact starburst galaxy known as SDSS J0905+57. The galaxy is located between about 5 and 6 billion light-years away, placing it almost halfway back through space-time. Using the Earth-orbiting WISE infrared observatory and the Hubble Space Telescope, the authors detected a very rapid burst of concentrated star formation taking place in the center of this galaxy. The mass of the stars in this galaxy is significantly larger than the mass of the Milky Way. The galaxy began starbursting, making lots of new stars, following a merger with another galaxy. Now, this process can torque gas in the galaxy to produce lots of new stars at its center. Follow-up microwave telescope observations using a set of interferometer dishes in the French Alps allowed the authors to study the flow of carbon monoxide in the galaxy's star-forming molecular clouds. And surprisingly, they found that the gas from which the stars were forming wasn't only concentrated in the center of the galaxy. Instead, around a third of this molecular cloud appeared to be spewing out of the galaxy at speeds over 1,000 kilometers per second. Hickox and colleagues couldn't find any signatures for other possible causes, such as an active supermassive black hole in the galactic center, which could explain their observations. All this molecular gas being driven out of the galaxy will most likely shut down the star formation process relatively quickly, in just a few tens or hundreds of millions of years or so, which is, believe it or not, actually quite a short period of time in terms of the lifespan of a galaxy. Now, according to Hickox, SDSS J0905+57 will then probably evolve into a giant elliptical galaxy with very little ongoing star formation taking place. The new findings support recent theoretical studies, which have in fact predicted just such a feedback mechanism, in which high-density star formation could generate enough radiation to push significant amounts of molecular gas out of a galaxy, stopping further star formation taking place. Hickox says the theory's been around for some time and it's been discussed a lot in the literature, but it's never actually been seen before.
We were using a microwave telescope to try to see how much dense gas was in this galaxy. And in particular, we were looking for light from the carbon monoxide molecule that we could observe at microwave frequencies. And we were trying to understand what is the content of the gas in this system, which we knew had a massive burst, a very rapid burst of concentrated star formation going on in the center of the galaxy. And surprisingly, what we found was that the gas from which you might expect the stars to be forming was not actually completely concentrated at the center of the galaxy, but some of it was offset from the center and appeared to be moving away. And so we unexpectedly discovered that some of the gas was actually getting, appeared to be blown out of the system.
So you get this happening when you've got young, new stars forming. They have very powerful radiation in their early stages. We call these tutori stars. This is sort of what one would expect to find, I guess.
Well, we do know that the young stars, they're really the hot, massive stars that are the ones that produce the most radiation. And we do know that this radiation can push on dust in the galaxy, which is mixed in with the gas, and dust is sort of like the consistency of smoke. They're very small particles. And we know that this radiation from these very hot, massive, short-lived stars, where the stars are forming, can push on this dust and help drive away some of the gas. So we know that this effect definitely can happen. What we didn't know was that it was capable of blowing the gas almost completely out of the galaxy or to a very large distance from the galaxy. So we definitely know it can happen on small scales. In fact, we see it happening in our own Milky Way galaxy. But we hadn't ever observed stars doing this on such a large scale before.
Are you sure this is cold molecular gas from an area where stars are being born and not an AGN or something like that?
That's a really good question. And this was something that we spent a lot of time thinking about, both actually in this particular project and also an earlier paper by our group that also came out this year. We were trying to understand whether or not it could actually be radiation from the growing black hole at the center of the galaxy that could be pushing on this gas and driving it away. We have observed systems where that appears to be happening, and we know that the black holes can produce a huge amount of radiation. But in this particular case, we looked for all different signatures that the black hole was growing and therefore producing this radiation, and we couldn't find any of them. However, what we did find is when you looked at the star formation going on in the galaxy, that it appears to be compact enough. So it's a huge amount of star formation going on in a very small region at the center of the galaxy, that it corresponds to the kind of density of star formation that some recent theoretical studies have predicted would be enough to do this kind of thing. And so it kind of surprised us that this could happen, but this particular process actually had been predicted by theorists not too long ago.
So what we've found out here, what your research has achieved, it's shown that star formation rates can have strong enough stellar winds, especially early on, to actually change the morphology of a galaxy, an evolving galaxy.
Yeah, that's what it looks like, for sure. I will say that, you know, we can't absolutely rule out, as things are often this way in science, we can't absolutely rule out that there actually was a black hole in this system that was growing in the past. And it has very rapidly turned off. And what we're seeing is the gas that was kicked out by that growing black hole. But that appears to be unlikely because when we look at a bunch of systems that look similar to this, there doesn't appear to be any real prevalence of growing black holes in them. And we think that the star formation, from a theoretical perspective, is good enough to do this.
That's Assistant Professor Ryan Hickox from Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. A new analysis of a Martian meteorite which fell to Earth in the Moroccan desert 3 years ago has reignited debate about the possibility of life on Mars. The meteorite named Tessint plummeted to Earth on July 18, 2011. Now, scientists from the Federal Polytechnic School in Lucerne, Switzerland, reporting in the journal Meteoritics and Planetary Sciences, claim a careful examination of cracks in the meteorite have revealed unique carbon traces. They claim the carbon has a very probable biological origin. The director of the school's Earth and Planetary Sciences Laboratory, Philippe Gillette, says so far there's no other theory that the team finds more compelling. The meteorite is one of a handful of rocks known to have been blasted off the red planet as ejected debris following asteroid impacts on Mars. It then presumably floated around in space until eventually captured by Earth's gravity, finally plunging down into the Moroccan desert of northern Africa. The study's authors report liquids containing carbon compounds soaked into the rock through cracks and fissures while it was still part of the Mars bedrock, long before the asteroid impact that sent it into space. Now, according to the new study, the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 is significantly lower than the ratio of carbon-13 in the carbon dioxide atmosphere of Mars, as measured by both the Phoenix lander mission and the Mars Curiosity rover. They've also excluded the possibility of contamination here on Earth following the meteor's impact in Morocco. They conclude that the carbon isotope ratios are identical to that found in coal, which is of biological origin. However, extraordinary claims do require extraordinary proof. To claim the carbon as a biological origin would require the discovery of complex organic molecules and not just interesting isotope ratios. The study does raise the possibility that the carbon could instead have originated from carbonaceous chondrite meteoroids, which would have a similar chemical and isotopic composition. Close at home now, and the Moon today has no global magnetic field, but a new review of scientific data has confirmed that billions of years ago, it had a much stronger magnetic field than the Earth's field is today. The findings, reported in the journal Science, answer long-standing questions about the Moon's origins and internal structure. However, they also raise new questions about how planetary magnetism actually works. The review by Professor Benjamin Weiss and Dr. Sonia Taku from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology confirmed that the Moon's magnetic field was generated by a molten liquid core, thus providing more additional support for the giant impact theory for the Moon's formation. A giant collision 4.5 billion years ago between a Mars-sized planet, which scientists have now called Theia, and the early proto-Earth melded both planets together, forming the Earth as we know it. While material ejected into space from that impact eventually coalesced to create the Moon. Rocks brought back from the Moon by NASA's Apollo missions confirmed that the Moon once had a magnetic field. And this new review has confirmed that the lunar magnetic field was at its strongest between 4.25 and 3.56 billion years ago. Earth's magnetic field is generated by the rotation and convection of electrically conducting fluids in the liquid outer core, creating what scientists refer to as a geodynamo, which turns the entire planet into a giant dipole magnet. However, scientists have long debated how a body as small as the Moon could possibly have generated a magnetic field. You see, given its small size, it should have cooled off very quickly, thereby solidifying its core. It's also difficult to understand exactly why a lunar magnetic field would have been so strong, especially given the small size of the lunar core. Regardless of the mechanism which kept the lunar core molten, Weiss and Taku still can't explain why the Moon's magnetic field would have been so strong in the past. Weiss admits that the findings suggest that science's understanding of how planets form magnetic fields is incomplete. The authors also found that the Moon's magnetic field suddenly switched off about 3.56 billion years ago. The solidification of a previously molten core would switch off a magnetic field. The thing is, reprocessed seismic experiments from the Apollo era have yielded mixed results, with some researchers claiming evidence for a solid lunar core, while others can't. Further adding to the confusion is a separate study published back in July and reported on Star Stuff, which discovered the existence of a molten layer along the Moon's core mantle boundary. This molten layer is caused by gravitational tidal heating generated by the Earth. By showing that the Moon's magnetic field was generated by a hot molten core, the authors have provided more evidence supporting the giant impact theory for the origins of the Moon. Weiss says this idea implies that the Moon started out really hot with a melted interior.
What we've begun to realize is the Moon's field was extremely strong, stronger than the Earth today, and it lasted for at least a billion years into its history. The question is, how could that be? It suggests that maybe our understanding of how planets generate magnetic fields is incomplete, and it's possible that the Moon generates field in a number of different exotic ways. So one possibility is that the Moon's core was stirred up in a different way, maybe not from cooling, the way the Earth and other planets seem to be operating, but maybe it was mechanically stirred up. Analogous to like if you take a cup and you put some water and you swish it around in a circle, you can basically make the water flow in kind of complex patterns. And that could happen to the Moon in the old days if the mantle, the solid outer part of the Moon, was moving with respect to the core. We know that's happening even today because the Moon's spin is wobbling. And the same thing occurring in the early days when the Moon was much closer to the Earth and was much more intense. Another idea is that the Moon's core was stirred up by motion of the overlying mantle because of large impacts on the surface of the Moon.
That was one of the ways to explain the anomaly in the southern far side of the Moon.
Right. So then there's this observation which is known since the Apollo era that the lunar crust is also magnetized, not just the rocks that we brought back. And strangely, the largest regions of magnetized crust are on the opposite side of some of the biggest and youngest impact craters in the Moon. So that led some people to suggest that maybe magnetization in lunar rocks doesn't tell us anything about the interior of the Moon, about the core. Maybe it's produced from magnetic fields that were generated by the impacts which made these big craters. Because impacts melt rock and they produce plasma, and you could get short-lived magnetic fields from that. So the big advance is so that question of was the Moon's magnetism generated by a core, like the Earth, or is it just a surficial phenomena from impacts on the surface? It has nothing to do with the interior of the moon. That was the question that sort of perplexed scientists for decades. In the last few years, we've begun to realize from new measurements that, in fact, much of the magnetization is from the core. It's not from these surficial impacts. And the way we could tell the difference is that magnetic fields produced in cores last a very, very long time, whereas magnetic fields from impacts only lasted most a day. And so we were able to demonstrate that many lunar rocks were magnetized over periods much longer than a day. So they had to have been exposed to a long-lived magnetic field like what you expect from the core. So that's one of the biggest new discoveries.
Okay, but that doesn't explain the incredible intensity of the magnetic field, does it?
Yes, so there are some open questions. How could the magnetic field on the moon be so intense as it seems to be the case from the records in our rock? And how could it live so long? One speculative idea is that some of these strange type of magnetic field generating mechanisms, like the wobble of the moon's spin axis, that dumps a lot of energy into the core, and it's possible that could make much stronger magnetic fields. It's also possible that the lunar magnetic field could have been powered for a very long time if the moon formed a solid inner core the way the Earth is. So the Earth's core is actually a two-layered structure. It's got a solid interior and it's got a liquid exterior. And if that happened on the moon, it could potentially power the lunar dynamo for a very long time.
That's Professor Benjamin Weiss from MIT. Well, after 9 years and a journey of more than 4.8 billion kilometres, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft has awakened from hibernation to begin preparing for its unprecedented mission to study the distant icy dwarf planet Pluto and its sibling worlds in the Kuiper Belt. Launched on an Atlas V rocket in 2006 from Space Launch Complex 41 at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida, New Horizons is now traveling at 16.26 kilometers per second. That's 58,536 kilometers an hour, making it the fastest spacecraft ever flown. The probe has just passed the orbit of Neptune, so far away that radio signals traveling at the speed of light take 4 hours and 25 minutes to reach Earth. The scientific observation of Pluto, its entourage of at least 5 moons and other frozen trans-Neptunian objects in the solar system's outer rim, begins on January the 15th, with closest approach to Pluto occurring on July 14th. Pluto and the other worlds of the Kuiper Belt orbiting the Sun beyond Neptune are believed to be leftovers from the formation of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. New Horizons lead researcher Dr. Alan Stern from the Southwest Research Institute says since its discovery in 1930 by Clive Tombaugh, Pluto has been a mystery. Scientists have struggled to explain why a planet, now a dwarf planet, with a radius of just 1,190 kilometres, about half the width of Australia, could come into existence beyond the giant worlds of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. In 1978, astronomers discovered that Pluto, located about 40 times further away from the Sun than Earth, wasn't alone, but was part of a binary system with a companion 604-kilometer-wide body, since named Charon, the pair orbiting each other around a common center of gravity. Since then, 4 other moons, Nix, Hydra, Kerberos, and Styx, have been discovered. Pluto's highly elliptical and eccentric 248 Earth-year orbit around the Sun takes it from inside the orbit of Neptune at 29 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun out to almost 49 times this distance. In 1992, astronomers discovered Pluto and Charon weren't alone but were part of a huge population of frozen debris, icy bodies and comets circling the Sun in similar orbits in a ring now called the Kuiper Belt. In 2006, with New Horizons already on its way, Pluto was formally stripped of its title as the 9th planet of the solar system. Instead, it has become reclassified as a dwarf planet, of which more than 1,000 have since been discovered in the Kuiper Belt. NASA's new Orion capsule has successfully completed its first test flight, splashing down in the Pacific Ocean off California 4 hours and 20 minutes after launching from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Base in Florida. The Orion capsule, which will be carried as the re-entry module for future manned missions beyond low Earth orbit, had blasted off on top of a Delta IV Heavy off Launch Complex 37 at Cape Canaveral.
Engine start box go.
Rock report range status.
Range green.
Everything is go.
GE main power off.
Main power off.
Upper stage LH2 secure at flight level.
35.
Status check.
Go Delta.
Go Orion. Green board.
Flight lock in.
T-minus 20 seconds.
15.
Rofi ignition.
The igniters have been lit.
9, 8,
seven, six.
Five, four, three, two, one, and liftoff at dawn. The dawn of Orion and a new era of American space exploration.
Good engine control in the first stage. Passing 25 seconds. Velocity 1,341 feet per second. Passing 31 seconds. Still looking good. Good engine control. Good chamber pressure in all three boosters in the full power mode. Standing by to go to the partial thrust mode in the core. And we have partial thrust command in the core. Core chamber pressure beginning to drop as expected as we're coming up on the 1 minute mark. 1 minute. 15 seconds into the flight. We have the hydrazine supply valve open in the second stage. 1 minute. 22 seconds in. Max Q, maximum dynamic pressure on the vehicle. Passing 124, Mach 1. Orion and Delta 4 now transcending the speed of sound. 1 minute, 31 seconds in. Good engine control in the first stage. Coming up 1 minute, 40 seconds. Velocity now 1,341 feet per second. Good engine control in the first stage. Passing Mach 5.
Riding atop a fountain of fire, the 24-story tall Delta IV Heavy, the biggest rocket in the current US fleet, soared out over the Atlantic Ocean. As it headed into orbit, Orion shed its protective panels and a launch escape system that would be needed to help future crews escape an accident during the climb into space. 3 hours and two orbits after launch, the unmanned cone-shaped Lockheed Martin-built capsule reached an altitude of 5,800 kilometers above the planet, a prelude to the most challenging part of the mission, a 32,000-kilometer-per-hour dive back into Earth's atmosphere. Orion survived the searing atmospheric re-entry plunge, its heat shield reaching temperatures of over 2,200 degrees Celsius, more than a third the temperature of the surface of the Sun, and gravitational forces greater than 8 Gs. Over the next few minutes, a total of 11 parachutes deployed to slow Orion's descent, including three gigantic main chutes that guided the spacecraft to a 32-kilometer-per-hour splashdown 1,014 kilometers southwest of San Diego.
25,000 feet. Time to splashdown, less than 4 minutes. Drogues have been deployed. 15,000 feet until splashdown. Coming up on main chute deploy, from a waypoint over the Pacific Ocean, there is your new spacecraft, America. Drogues away. Main chute deploy. On mains, everything looking good. Good reefing reported. Three good main chutes reported from the USS Anchorage from a high speed rate of 20,000 miles an hour to a gentle return back to Earth more than 4 hours and 20 minutes after it took off on a Delta IV heavy rocket from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Winds at the surface just about 12 knots. Wave heights no more than about 4.5 feet or so. Perfect conditions for Orion's homecoming. Just a few hundred feet until splashdown. Splashdown confirmed at 10:29 a.m. Central Time. Orion is back on Earth. America has driven a golden spike as it crosses a bridge into the future.
Mission managers are now sifting through the exabytes of data from the more than 1,200 onboard sensors, which have recorded every moment of the spacecraft's performance, including how it weathered surges of radiation and, of course, how it handled its fiery re-entry. In fact, the point of the flight, which cost NASA some $375 million, was to verify that Orion's 5-meter diameter heat shield, parachutes, avionics, and other equipment would work as designed prior to putting people aboard the spacecraft. NASA's been developing Orion along with a new heavy lift rocket called the SLS for more than 8 years. The design of the rockets changed dramatically, leaving Orion, sole survivor of the cancelled Constellation Lunar Exploration Program, to become the centerpiece of a new human space initiative intended to fly crews beyond the low Earth orbit of the International Space Station. NASA's so far spent more than $9 billion developing Orion, which will make a second test flight, also without crew, in about 4 years' time. In fact, it won't be till its third mission around 2021 when astronauts will fly aboard the capsule for the first time. That'll be quite some test flight as they plan to do a loop around the moon. Since the end of the Apollo moon program in 1972, no astronauts have flown beyond low Earth orbit, altitudes of around 400 kilometers to the International Space Station and 500 kilometers to service the Hubble Space Telescope. Orion's debut test flight had originally been slated for Thursday, but weather issues, a boat straying into the restricted area, and a glitch with the United Launch Alliance Delta IV Heavy rocket all conspired to delay the flight until the weekend. NASA's Jay Boland describes the Orion test flight as the first step on the road to having people walk on Mars.
Everybody over here, to kind of borrow a phrase, is actually over the moon. We're extremely excited this week about the possibility of Orion going successfully, and now that we saw it splash down in the Pacific, we're all extremely happy about that.
Jay Boland is with NASA's Johnson Space Center. He says there are big plans ahead for the Orion.
Actually, the last human on the moon was 42 years ago. That was Apollo 17. So it's been quite some time since another human's walked another planetary surface. So we're looking forward to, in the next 10 to 15 years, having someone walk upon Mars. But before we get there, we're going to be hopefully capturing an asteroid and exploring an asteroid. So that's our next big step for NASA.
So what would be the significance of getting a human to Mars?
Well, the significance is obviously exploration. That's what NASA has been, the tenets NASA has been founded on, trying to get above and beyond and to see what is out there in our lower solar system, and as well as trying to explore our galaxy. So Orion's the first great step in that direction.
Jay Boland from NASA, ending that report by the ABC's Sarah Sedgi. Japan's next mission to rendezvous with an asteroid has successfully blasted into space aboard an H-2A rocket from the Tanegashima Space Center south of Tokyo. The Hayabusa 2 spacecraft is on a 6-year sample return mission to study the kilometer-wide asteroid 1999
JU-3.
Thermal batteries activation.
All systems are ready.
Main engine ignition.
We had a liftoff of the H-2A launch vehicle number 26 with the Hayabusa 2 and 3 secondary payloads on board from the Tanegashima Space Center at 1:22:04 p.m. on December 3, 2014, Japan Standard Time.
The Hayabusa 2 mission is expected to reach the asteroid in mid-2018 and will then spend around 18 months studying the rock. By the way, the name Hayabusa means peregrine falcon in Japanese. The refrigerator-sized spacecraft will map the surface of the asteroid before touching down, deploying small explosives to blast a crater and then collect the resulting subsurface ejecta and debris, which had been unexposed to a millennia of solar wind and radiation. The mission hopes to answer fundamental questions about life and the formation of the solar system. Hayabusa 2 will also drop tiny robots on the asteroid's surface. If all goes well, asteroid samples should be returned to Earth sometime late in 2020. Asteroid 1999 JU-3 was discovered by the LINA project. Its spectral signature indicates that it's a carbonaceous or C-type Apollo asteroid. Apollo asteroids are near-Earth asteroids which cross Earth's orbit around the Sun. The February 15, 2013 Chelyabinsk meteor, which exploded in the skies above the southern Urals region of Russia, injuring over 1,200 people and causing billions in damage, was also an Apollo asteroid. The launch of the Hayabusa 2 had been postponed twice because of bad weather. The first Hayabusa probe, launched in 2003, was unable to collect as much material as hoped for, but still made history by being the first vehicle to bring back samples from an asteroid. Its 7-year mission ended in 2010 when it blazed a trail across the South Australian outback, landing on the Woomera rocket range. And that's the show for now. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can also subscribe to the show as a weekly podcast through iTunes or download it from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. You can also check out the Star Stuff blog, which contains all the space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some of the most spectacular cosmic images you'll ever see and other things I find amusing. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com. That's all one word in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And don't forget the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations, and publishing details. Just type in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.